and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition, a July 13th edition Warrior Connection. Well, you know, it'd be great if all the nations would respect each other, but I don't think it's going to happen in my lifetime. It just seems like we continuously head towards war or in the Middle East. It's just coming unglued all the time as we talk. We just watched the news a few minutes ago, and it seems like Israel and the Palestinians are going to go at it. We got all the nightmare up in Iraq, Syria, Iran, going all the way across the whole thing. So we need to talk about tonight. Matt, are you with us tonight?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Matt. Glad to have you. Matt, you've been doing a lot of work on this and everything that's happening in the Middle East. You've been brokering for peace. You've been working up in Washington trying to get peace stuff. What is happening? Why has the world gone nuts again?
Well, I think that there are a lot of reasons, and U.S. policy is certainly one of them. There are issues that run much deeper and that are more complicated for a one-hour TV show or radio show, let alone a 1,000-page volume. So, you know, from my point of view, I think when I was in Iraq in 2004, that war, which lasted around 8 years, and our policies in the Middle East with Iran stretching back all the way to the 70s and with, you know, Iraq into the 70s and 80s, I think the U.S. has had a lot of influence on what's happened in the past and what's happening right now. And, you know, there are a lot of people who try to explain it through the resource prism, through the, sort of ethnic ideology prism. And I think each of those factors and many more play a small role. And I think the thing that we could actually do to aid the situation, make things maybe a little bit better, is to stop militarizing our policy toward the Middle East.
It seems like the militarization goes back, because I'm sitting here going back to the Sykes-Picot Agreement back in May of 1916, and the British and the French had already gone in there, and the U.S. obviously jumped in, but that's at the time of World War One, when the French and the British decided to divvy up the whole Middle East and control everything,
right,
from resources and military and everything else. And it's not stopped then since then, has it?
Yeah, it's a shocking thing when you look at the context, and what you just explained is so important. Sykes-Picot, for those who don't know, is essentially an agreement that drew red lines across the Middle East and drew up countries and divided them, much like colonialism did in Africa. And, you know, we see the remnants of it. A lot of places, especially Iraq, is a really good example. Iran is another good example of where national identities have been formed, and they have sort of ebbed and flowed over time. But it seems like a lot of these national identities are in crisis now, and a lot of that has been fomented by interference from foreign nations in the Middle East, in countries like Iraq.
Why does it seems like the United States continues, I mean, since I've been involved in the Middle East, obviously got totally involved during Desert Storm, we somehow had the idea that we were their big daddy or their big brother, or we could tell them what to do in order to control the resources and tell them what to do. And then the other thing seems to me everybody forgets, yes, we have all the different factions. You've got the Shiites and Sunnis and all the different factions, but they're still Arab. And when we start intervening in there, it doesn't matter whether they're Shiites or Sunnis or whatever they are, they're not going to like foreign intervention.
Right, yeah. And well, you know, the truth is, neither would we. If China invaded the U.S. to liberate the country from Barack Obama, all of the right-wing type conservatives wouldn't say, oh, I guess we're with China now, even though they don't like Obama. The truth is, no one likes foreign intervention, and that doesn't have to be international military intervention. It could also be, you know, intervention from your neighbors next door to your own house in a way that you feel is inappropriate. So it's certainly not just a characteristic of people in the Middle East, of Arabs, of Shiites, of Sunnis, or what have you. And the truth is, you know, one thing I've really noticed in these last few weeks, and of course this has been true for a long time, but it was especially glaring recently, is that a lot of the pundits on TV don't know much about the Middle East. There was one general, former brigadier general, who was being interviewed on CNN, and he was talking about the Sunni sort of insurgency, ISIL and others, saying, these people are the violent ones. And then he turned and said, well, the Kurds, he started sort of waxing poetically about how how stable their region is, and so on and so forth, without realizing that, you know, a lot of them are also Muslim. So it's really an interesting dynamic unfolding.
There's so much the people in control don't have the knowledge thereof, and they don't study it. And then when they do have the experts like yourself and others that are trying to get the information out, it seems like too often the true experts are disregarded, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. Well, and the reason, I think, is because the situation is so complicated and the dynamics are so complicated. And our 24-hour media cycle does not allow for complication. It really only tolerates brevity. And when you have to boil down, decades of history into this somewhat false dichotomy of Sunni versus Shia, you're inevitably going to leave out some very crucial details. So in my view, the media doesn't really cause the problem, but it certainly perpetuates it, especially in this country where the people just don't really pay that much attention.
People don't want to know either, do they?
It's often my experience that they don't. And that's also frustrating because, people often can be very opinionated without having much of an understanding about where their opinions are rooted or really being that invested in their opinion. So that can be sometimes pretty troubling.
Yes, I'm just wondering, Patricia, have you been able to join us yet by chance? Okay, well, Matt, I guess we're just there. We're hoping a couple other people are going to join us.
Mm-hmm, great.
Is Ross there by chance yet? Okay, we got a couple other experts, when we all set this up. What's happening up in Washington right now as far as the Middle East is concerned? What are the thoughts? What are the ideas? What are the insights, plans, or what's happening? Or is it just a complete bamboozled mess?
Well, you know, I'm actually pretty optimistic about what's happening up on the Hill. There are some war powers-related discussions happening. There has been legislation introduced regarding the 2002 authorization of the use of military force in Iraq. And there is currently a letter, which Barbara Lee of California is leading, which I believe, actually, it might not be public how many people are on it. I know the letter has been discussed publicly, but I'm not sure that the co-sponsors are or have been discussed publicly, so I better not mention that. But just to say, there are people working right now on the Hill to show there is opposition to the way that President Obama has chosen to interpret his executive authority in matters relating to Iraq. Essentially, what it boils down to is there was an authorization of the use of military force for Iraq in 2002 passed by the House and Senate, and it was controversial. Not everyone supported it. And that AUMF, as it's known, never expired and is currently, we believe that the U.S., this Barack Obama's administration is using that AUMF to take all the actions it's currently taking and to plan the actions it may take. So that also, by the way, not to confuse anyone, but it's also important to note that that 2002 AUMF is different than the 2001 AUMF, which has been in the media recently, that relating to Al-Qaeda and perpetrators of 9/11. The Iraq AUMF in 2002 was a separate AUMF altogether, which is really interesting because, you know, the sort of justification for the Iraq war, Iraq having Al-Qaeda ties and Saddam having Al-Qaeda ties, it's sort of a pretty flimsy case, so much so that Congress decided to pass another authorization. And that wasn't the sole reason behind that 2002 AUMF, but it's sort of an interesting irony in a way.
What are some of the players in the Middle East that we have right now? Obviously, we got a puppet government in Iraq. We got a puppet government in Afghanistan. Iran is, I'm not even sure where Iran is at whatsoever. We got Syria is obviously they're trying to destabilize that government and do it. We got Israel coming unglued. We got Palestine coming unglued. We got Turkey up there that had what they've been battling the Kurds along the southern border forever and ever, and the Kurds in northern Iraq have been battling the Iraqis forever and ever. So what are all the different, can you go over some of the different players that are and who they are and what they consist of?
Yeah, you summarized it pretty well. And the truth is, It's extremely complicated because not all of the people involved, you know, take Iraq for an example. You've got the predominantly Shiite Iraqi government led by Nouri al-Maliki, and the predominantly Shiite Iraqi military, which is sort of running the show, if you will, in Iraq. And a lot of the people who are involved in, let's say, the uprising against Nouri al-Maliki, we hear in the media that it's ISIL, which is Islamic State in the Levant, ISIL, and it goes by a couple different names, but that's sort of one of the most common, and it's quickly becoming the most accepted. ISIL is only one component of this uprising. Much of the uprising, we don't know numbers, we don't have an idea of statistics, but much of the uprising is comprised of people who have legitimate grievances related to what they feel is unfair treatment of the Sunni minority. You've got different imams and different religious leaders. You've got tribal leaders, all with grievances, feeling like the central government of Iraq has not served them or their needs. And that is a huge portion of the groups in Iraq resisting the government of Nouri al-Maliki. Now, the interesting thing, and sort of one of the big reasons why I think the U.S. should not intervene militarily, is, you know, for the majority of those people, the majority of that minority, the Nouri al-Maliki government does not represent them. And it's not viewed, as you mentioned, you called it a puppet government, I would say an illegitimate government. It's not viewed as legitimate by the majority of those Sunni minorities, nor, frankly, of a lot of the Shiites in Iraq. So what you have when the U.S. and others come to the aid of the Maliki government is sort of this scenario where there's a legitimate a movement with legitimate grievances rising to push back against what they view as an illegitimate government. And then the U.S. is back in the picture supporting what they view as an illegitimate government. And it becomes very, very problematic. So that's sort of one component of what you described. You know, I'm not really an expert on Syria. I don't know all of the groups involved there, but I know there are many. I know their agendas differ. And Assad has certainly one main agenda, and that's to stay in power. And some of these other splinter groups have different agendas. You know, there are also Chechens involved in this conflict, which is sort of an interesting thing because, you know, we know that Russia is close to the Assad regime. We know that Russia is close to the Iranians. And it's interesting to see Chechens who, some of whom are involved with the Russian government, involved in what's happening, especially in Syria, but also in the Islamic State in the Levant, which is ISIL. The group in Iraq. So, you know, it's a much more complicated picture than just a bunch of Sunnis versus a bunch of Shias. And I certainly can't do it all justice. It would take a PhD in some of these topics to really understand it all and give you a full review. But that's sort of my take.
Now, Saudi Arabia is Sunni, correct?
That's correct.
And so Saudi Arabia is on the other side because Iran now is Shiite. Before, I mean, Iran is Shiite. Now Iraq has taken over as Shiite. Before, all the stuff started back in 1990,
right.
Basically Shiite.
You know, I have to say, I kind of try to, I know I've been using those labels, but and when I talk in the sort of the bigger picture, I think there's been this tendency of the U.S., especially the U.S. media, to label sides, you know, them, that group versus the other group, sort of that us versus them mentality, which is so pervasive in our foreign policy. And I think it's kind of problematic and simplistic. You know, yes, the Saudis are predominantly Sunni. Is that their motivating factor? Is that the main reason they act the way they do in the region? Is that their motive for acting? I don't think so. I think it's a small component. But this is power dynamics 101. You know, this is a power over a power under situation. It's about subversion. It's about control. It's about, in a way, it's about resources, but not necessarily in the way we all think. So it's a very complicated landscape. And if we just look at these simple labels, it's sort of the reason why the U.S. got in trouble in Syria. We wanted to support groups that were opposing the Assad regime. It just so happened that one of those groups was Al Nusra, which has been associated with Al Qaeda and deemed a terrorist organization by some. I'm not sure if it's been deemed by the U.S. government, but I think it hasn't. But by many analysts, it has been deemed a terrorist organization. And the U.S. was sort of in between trying to support both of those sides. I think that's the point you may have been trying to get to, is that it's a very complicated thing, and we're sort of on both sides of this.
Where does Jordan come into play?
You know, Jordan has been it's been absorbing a lot of refugees from Syria, from Iraq, and from other places. It's been an ally of the U.S. and sort of not just the Western world, but of, I would say, the weaponized world for a long time. I'm not sure that you know, but there's an annual, very large weapons conference in Jordan pretty much every year, where you can, a country can go and talk to defense contractors, small and large, and purchase weapons. That happens in Jordan every year. The Jordanian government is a relatively stable one compared to most in the region. But it too has some significant issues and has felt resistance from small minorities in their population. So it's again sort of just one more layer of the onion, and it's as always a complicated onion.
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Did we have Patricia? Did you join us, or Ross? Okay. Yeah, Matt. So we got what about Lebanon? That's also another player in this thing, isn't it?
It is, and I'm not sure if you heard recently, but the someone on the Lebanon side of the border fired rockets at Israel, and Israel responded. Of course, we know that Lebanon and Israel have a long history of both ideological and religious divisions, but a long military history as well. They've stayed relatively uninvolved on the sort of grand scale so far, but it looks like that's changing. And you mentioned sort of Israel-Palestine earlier. I mean, I think the way this is trending is we're looking at a regional war, and it's a regional war in a way that is one of the most dangerous kind, where you have somewhat small skirmishes building into bigger and bigger skirmishes, but that are sort of unrelated. What's happening between the Israelis and the Palestinians, could be traced back further. But if you look just at face value at the recent events with the kidnapping of three Israeli teenagers and so on, that's somewhat unrelated from what's happening with the Nouri al-Maliki government in Iraq. But somehow these conflicts may just bleed into each other. And when we have such a widespread regional war, it's hard to imagine the U.S. And other countries not getting involved a little more deeply. Right now, we're very much involved at a proxy level, but it really is one of the most concerning things in terms of the future.
What is the size of this? I guess, we don't have any idea or any concept of the areas, the dimensions, how much land area this covers, or where everything is. Could you go over that a little bit? Is this, how big is this? Is this like, a couple of states put together, or is it the whole
right.
part of the United States, or what are the dimensions and everything involved here?
Right. Well, Israel is about the size of New Jersey, square mileage-wise. The West Bank is obviously just one small component of that. Gaza is something like 5 miles wide and 20 miles long. So they're all relatively small areas. Iraq is roughly the size of Texas. And then you have Iran, which is probably not quite double that size, but somewhere in that vicinity. Yemen and Oman are also relatively small. Qatar is very small. The United Arab Emirates is probably landmass-wise similar, square mileage-wise, to, say, probably West Virginia, maybe West Virginia and Maryland, something like that. So it's a pretty small, overall pretty small area compared to, say, the United States. But if you're talking about capturing and holding territory, it's enormous. It's beyond the scope of what one army can do. And I think we saw that in Iraq with the U.S. military. We had 160,000 troops there deployed there at our height and really struggled to hold and clear and maintain areas. I think a war that is regional in nature, involving all of the regional players, but even some foreign interveners like the U.S. say would be a very long, very drawn-out, very guerrilla-style conflict.
Now, with all these different groups coming into play, and within the countries, they're all splinter groups within the countries themselves. So if I'm sensing it right, within the countries, you've got groups within the countries that are allied with other groups in another country. You've got some countries that are aligned together. You've got other governments within those countries that on the public might be aligned together, but in a sense are in the opposite poles.
Right. Yeah, like I said, it's incredibly complicated. And this is to me the quintessential point, because it's very difficult. I'm sure the Pentagon and the CIA have big charts where they sort of map this all out and map out the interconnectedness of these different groups. But the reality is we don't understand them very well. And if one is to militarize further our policy by sending weapons, by arming and training, whatever the case may be, it's going to become, in my view, very ugly very quick. And I think that's sort of what we're seeing now sort of unfold. And we're seeing the results of decades of militarized foreign policy, not just our own, but the policy of others as well. So, it's the reason, in my view, that the U.S. shouldn't add more bombs and bullets to the overall tally.
Well, when we go back to the Iraq-Iranian war, the United States provided Iraq with the chemical weapons, biological weapons that they used on Iran. That's a given fact. We know that happened. We then had the chem-bio weapons that Iraq had at the beginning of Desert Storm that we destroyed beginning November and December 1990, and they were all gone by within a couple of years. But then we had all the Iraqi military equipment that had been provided both by the U.S. and Russia and Great Britain and Germany and everybody, that when we got captured, got distributed all over the place. And then we were arming all these different groups. So we're arming Turkey, we're arming Jordan, we're arming Lebanon, we're arming Syria. Now we've been arming Iraq with new weapons as we try to recreate their military. Iran has got weapons from everybody and their brother. And now you've got Syria coming in. So we do know that U.S. weapons were given to Syria, Iraqi weapons were given to Syria. And now the Syrians and whatever these other groups are coming back apart, are coming across, and they're just acquiring the weapons that we gave to them, basically. I mean, it's sort of like we gave these weapons to you because we thought you were a good guy one day. Well, the next day you're no longer a good guy, but we gave you the weapons you have already.
Right, yeah. Yeah, and, you know, in 2004, we had a cash for weapons program where essentially in order to get weapons off the streets and keep them out of the hands of insurgents, the U.S. military was paying hefty sums to purchase everything from bayonets and AK-47s up through RPGs and mortar sheds. And what it actually did was create a system where people were smuggling weapons in order to get paid for them. So this is an area of the world that is not unfamiliar to military-grade weapons, and in fact, it was very common to find AK-47s in the houses of ordinary civilian Iraqis. So, you know, whether or not it has been sort of an intentional policy of the U.S. over all of these years to just arm each and every one of these groups and countries to the teeth and then see what happens, or whether or not it's happened by accident, which is sort of what I tend to believe. It's sort of, there's not been one monolithic policy, but a lot of really bad small policies. To me, it just, again, shows, it demonstrates why the U.S. shouldn't continue to further militarize our policy in the region. It, once again, here we are, and as you very clearly stated, we've given weapons to so many different countries and so many different groups so many different times. If we continue to do that, we're only going to worsen the situation.
Now, the infrastructure over there, what's left of it? I mean, this whole area has been under continual bombardment. We got a war in Syria. We got wars in Lebanon. We got wars in Iran, Iraq, Kuwait, northern Saudi Arabia, into Turkey.
Right.
I mean, so much infrastructure has been destroyed. I know when I read up on this before we went to Desert Storm, Iraq had a world-class medical system, had a world-class education system, world-class industrial system.
Yeah.
And now they basically can't even get rid of the raw sewage that they have. The hospital system has been destroyed. So what is left as far as an infrastructure within these, within all of these countries? Is there anything there at all to sustain a nightmare that we're anticipating?
It's incredibly sad what you just pointed out. You know, I haven't been in Iraq since 2004, and that's practically a lifetime. But the U.S. spent a lot of money building things, not hospitals, not roads, not necessarily institutions of education, that we did build those. We spent a lot of money building things like water parks that there, of course, you know, no one would be able to maintain. We spent a lot of money pretty frivolously. So the investment that was made in Iraqi infrastructure in the last 10 years was not made in a sustainable way. It was actually made in a very corrupt way, as far as I'm concerned, for the most part. And, you know, one has to wonder what is left. I don't know, because I haven't been there in 10 years, but my sense is, just based on what was there when I was there, which is relatively little, there were two roads that ran north-south that were major highways in Iraq, and there are a lot of splinter roads off of that. There wasn't a lot of infrastructure to speak of. There were some sort of semi-high-rise buildings. But most people, you know, there were large swaths of just desert. And most people in these rural, very far-out villages lived in homes made out of local material, mostly mud and brick and some wood, very limited amount. And, you know, I imagine a lot of that's still there, but... yeah, if you are an Iraqi who gets hurt in one of those small areas because of fighting, you're in pretty big trouble, I think.
What? Boy, it just seems like it's a nightmare.
Absolutely.
I mean, we've got all these problems. Now, the other stuff that has showed up right now, the United States and everything has been caught spying again on Germany, all right? We've been caught all over the world, so we're pulling shenanigans off under control and what we call our, you know, our right to do it as Big Daddy, whatever.
National security, right?
Yeah, exactly. We're being caught all over. What is happening? I mean, you got the Germans getting mad. You got the French, Venezuelan, Brazilians being mad. You got the French mad. You got the Turks mad. You got Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Syria, Lebanon. You got Egypt. You got boy. What?
Yeah. Well, the list just goes on. You know, I mean, it's not a new thing for the U.S. or for any country, for that matter, to spy on both its friend and its enemy. So you know, it's not that new. What's new is the techniques that we're using. It's not it's not old school espionage where you had to really work to find those secrets and find people you could turn in a way. Basically, it's just, you know, hacking and collecting data on a massive scale. So, you know, I think it's a really big misstep for the U.S. to continue to spy on even a country like Germany, who's our ally. You know, on some level, reconnaissance and intelligence and surveillance is a necessary function. But when I think we've gone completely overboard and and really, you know, one day that bill is going to come due, because we can't really, I don't think the U.S. can do that with impunity. You know, someone, we know right now that we're being spied on, no doubt about it, individually, but the U.S. government is also being spied on by people who are both our allies and our enemies, maybe not in quite the same way, but it's sort of standard operating procedure. But the question is, if, you know, if we're, you know, wiretapping the cell phone of Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, there's pretty much no limit to what we'll try to do. And I think that's going to really turn off a lot of people. And rather than living in a world that's cooperative, where the curtains are up and everyone's talking, we're going to live in a world where, you know, there's a whole lot more secretive things happening. I think it's essentially just the wrong way to go.
What is happening up in Washington, D.C.? Do you have any sense of either staff members or members of Congress, either the House or the Senate or in the administration, that are urging or expressing great caution, or is everybody kind of running amok?
Oh, no, no doubt. You know, you've got folks like Adam Schiff who are urging caution on policies like U.S. drone strikes and things like that. You've got people like Justin Amash, who's a Republican from Michigan, I think a two-term Republican at this point, who's offered amendments to authorization and appropriations bills that would defund or deauthorize NSA and other elements of our spying apparatus. There have been some elements of the NSA that have been defunded by one chamber or the other, but not yet by both. So there's, you know, there's movement. The fact that the Obama administration recently released this drones memo on the, you know, justification of targeted killing of U.S. citizens, I think is potentially a big step. And they had sort of, I think, internal, somewhat political reasons for doing it. But, you know, the calls for transparency and accountability are bipartisan. Republicans and Democrats are making those calls. Unfortunately, it's not the Republicans and the Democrats in leadership. It's not the Republicans and Democrats that have a lot of power and a lot of stake in the game, nor is it the administration who is making these calls, but mostly somewhat junior members or members who are not junior but who are somewhat marginalized because of their political views. So you essentially have a setup where there are people working on different aspects of this. Just to give you one concrete example, and this summer, I think it was in June, there was an amendment offered on the National Defense Authorization Act that would have sunset and repealed the 2001 AUMF that I mentioned earlier, and it got 191 votes, which is, you know, not too far off passing, just about 27 off of passing, 27 yes votes. So that's pretty impressive. You know, the 2000 AUMF was passed 420 to 1 in the House and unanimously in the Senate you know, 13 years ago. And now we have 191 members of the House voting to repeal it, and the Senate has not come forth with a concrete plan on how it plans to address the AUMF. It's still a pretty contentious debate there. But it is we're seeing movement. Members, you know, new and old, are sort of voicing concern about these policies. And it seems like it just sort of keeps getting more and more egregious, to be frank, these policies do. So the more that happens, the more we're likely to see people speaking out.
Now, the other thing, too, obviously you've been following this, and I know you and I have discussed this, and you've been on this radio show before, the health effects on the U.S. military as far as the broken VA and Department of Defense medical system. We've got millions of casualties who can't get medical care. So
right,
this is what's happened to the U.S. military. Now, our coalition forces, obviously, I mean, we're picking up the same thing that the coalition forces that we had obviously have to be very sick themselves. But then what happens, all these so-called enemy forces and all the civilians in the areas, they can't, you know, if we're all sick, they got to be sick too. So what is happening with that?
Oh, yeah. Well, from that standpoint, nothing. I mean, it's incredibly tragic. I think this is, to me, the legacy, in a nutshell, of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the wars that are happening as a result of really bad foreign policy on our part and the part of many other countries involved. You know, look, in Iraq, for example, and Afghanistan, roughly 2.5 million people will have served by the time we leave Afghanistan, which right now is set to be around 2016. 2.5 million veterans, you know, you're talking about a very small percentage of the population. When you include family members, you're talking about between 1% and 2% of the population has served or been directly affected by these wars. 1% to 2%, you know, you think back just not even 100 years ago to World War II, when everybody felt the impact of the war, whether they were serving, whether they were, you know, women driving ambulances and working as nurses, or whether they were people back here with their victory gardens and their rations, everyone felt the effect of the war. And you just don't have that today. So people are automatically just very disconnected. Now, you've got, you know, like I said, 2.5 million people or so, you know, serving in these wars. You've got 25 million people living in Iraq. You've got 29 million people living in Afghanistan. Every single one of them has been touched and affected by these wars. We've got tens of thousands, maybe up to 1 million killed in Iraq. We've got millions internally displaced and refugees in both countries. We have dramatically destabilized the region. You know, we had roughly 3,500 or 35,000 people that became refugees, internal refugees, internally displaced peoples, after Hurricane Katrina in 2005 in this country. And we saw the response. We saw how difficult it was for people to, or for communities to absorb those internally displaced peoples. Now, you know, look at a place like Iraq, and you've got 1 million people to 2 million. We're not even really quite sure. You know, a reasonable estimate is around 2 million refugees that are now flooding into other countries in the region. And you think, even in the context of what's going on today, we've got, you know, thousands of children flooding across the border. We're only talking in the thousands, and the U.S. is really struggling to deal with and absorb and deport or whatever we're doing with these young kids. Imagine millions of people who are flooding into your country and flooding into, say, you know, neighboring countries. It's really incomprehensible to our brains, because we have nothing really relevant or no really relevant experience to compare it to. But now back to the medical VA medical crisis. You know, there are two parts to this problem. You know, yes, the VA is dealing with some 900,000 backlogged cases right now. The VA has about 400,000 post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injury claims right now that it's dealing with that are somewhat delinquent. They're delayed in their treatment. That's a huge number. But what the U.S. Army and the Marine Corps and the Air Force and others have been doing over the last 10 years is essentially not taking care of the troops while they were in. When someone was developing PTSD, they were either forced to go back to the battlefield, they were diagnosed with some kind of personality disorder, and they were sent off to, kicked out, rather, sometimes with other than honorable discharges.
Well, then their medical problems were just thrown back, and the medical problems became complicated, where they were,
right,
you know, dealing with pain pills and all this other stuff to keep going.
Right.
And so they were medically unfit for duty, and yet they're shoved back into a nightmare where they end up being basket cases.
Right. Either that happens, or they're kicked out of the military and then put on the VA's role. And the VA is sort of like the tethered goat in all of this. They're the political scapegoat for all of the bad things happening with veterans care, but the military is sort of getting off scot-free. This is actually illuminated very well in a report that was recently published by the group Iraq Veterans Against the War. And it's they essentially had been working down in Fort Hood in Killeen, Texas. It's one of the largest army bases in the country, and one of the most frequently deployed and one of the most, immersed in these mental health issues. And they basically, over the course of the last couple of years, have been working on this Right to Heal campaign, a campaign saying that these troops have earned the right to heal before they're ever, you know, sent back to a battlefield. And they published this report with over 300 pages of testimonials from people who experienced really poor treatment by the U.S. Army at Fort Hood in Killeen, Texas. And, were essentially kicked off the payroll and sent to be the VA's problem. And now you've got this epidemic, this very large problem that the VA is dealing with in terms of numbers that is not to fall squarely on the shoulders of the VA. You know, the VA has been doing a relatively poor job serving the veterans of this country, no doubt about it. But we shouldn't let the military completely off the hook in their own
responsibility. No, the military is. I think the military has gone about disavowing all of the effects and the health effects from their military operations, toxic chemical compounds, depleted uranium, pesticides. I mean, all of us are horribly affected by that. And I don't know hardly anybody that doesn't have a significant disability. But then at the same time, what we see over and over and over again is both the Department of Defense and the VA disavow any connection between all these guys were extraordinarily healthy. All of us were extraordinarily healthy and came back sick, and they disavow any connection, so therefore they don't assume any responsibility. And now the frustration and the PTSD and the suicides and child and spouse abuse and crime is out of control.
Right. Yeah. And I actually want to come back to that, the issue of suicide, because this is a very personal issue for me. I lost my first friend in 2004 to a roadside bomb, but I lost my most recent friend in 2012 to suicide. And I don't say that he committed suicide. I say that he died by suicide because he effectively was a victim. He was a victim in a way that we don't really think people are victims, but he was a victim of a system. A system that did not serve him once he became sick. And, you know, he was not like a mentally ill guy. He was just someone who was trying to make it in life and had some pretty dark demons that he was trying to deal with. And he couldn't get the help he needed from the VA. He was waiting for a year to get an appointment, and it was about just over a year when he died by suicide. So, and I want to speak more broadly about this topic because I think it's very, very important. I do not believe that violence and war are a natural part of the human condition. I know that we like to say that. I know that even anthropologists like to say that war is sort of a natural part of the human condition. But I don't think that's true, because if you look at violence against individuals, and this is one of my friends who's a former Army captain. These are his words. His name is Paul Chappelle. He's written about this extensively, so I definitely recommend looking into his writings. But what Paul says is basically no human being has ever been traumatized by an act of kindness. And it's true. You know, if you open the door for someone, they don't look at you and say, "You're such a jerk, I'm calling the cops." You know, they say, "Thank you." But almost universally, if someone is impacted by an act of violence against their will, they experience some kind of trauma. And it doesn't really necessarily matter if it's rape, if it's gun violence, if it's the violence of war. People experience trauma either way. And there are a lot of deep-rooted issues with why people experience that trauma. But the reality, in my view, is that human beings are not inherently violent. If human beings were inherently violent, we would be developing post-traumatic stress because we didn't have enough war. But we don't develop post-traumatic stress when we don't have war. We live in peace. We live in harmony. We at least try to do that. But when we deploy our young men and women to war, they experience violence, and it's sometimes against their will, even when they expect it. But it's violence that is so profound and so far-reaching that it affects them on a deep psychological level. And it effectively, in my view, is a moral injury. It is an injury to the psyche. And the reason the VA can't fix it with their cognitive behavioral therapy and their cocktail of pills is because one has to look inward in order to be able to fix that. And the VA and the military and other agencies and other organizations serving veterans have to come to realize that we need the tools to look inward. We need the tools for self-reflection, whether that's yoga or meditation or hard workouts, whatever it is. We need to figure that out. We need help figuring that out. And to me, that's what's going to help solve the problems of the people who have already experienced this trauma. In the future, my sincerest hope is that we stop deploying our young men and women to fight these wars, because we as a species, as humankind, have to evolve past this incredibly juvenile way of solving geopolitical problems, or we will perish. It is as simple as that. We will either evolve past this, or we will not make it as a species. We have not been on Earth this long. Our ancestors, Homo erectus, lived about 7 times longer than Homo sapiens have. Neanderthals lasted a little bit longer than we have currently lasted. But we as Homo sapiens will not last, both if we don't recognize the futility of fighting these wars and the imperative of solving bigger, larger, real issues like global climate disruption.
Wow. Thank you, Matthew. That was more than I ever dreamed of. Do you see any hope up there in Washington? I mean, you've up in the legislation. You're working up there on the Hill. You're working day in and day out for peace and justice and guess what we're going to call it, trying to do what's right. Do you see a hope and a dream that we have people up there, whether they're staffers or people in Congress, that have that vision and really want to make a difference?
Well, yeah, you know, members of Congress are effectively, and truly the entire city of Washington, D.C., the think tanks, the advocacy organizations, everybody is sort of governed by inertia. And whether or not things move and things happen and visions become reality really depends on whether or not the average constituent, the average citizen, is engaged in government. And I don't mean protesting. I don't mean standing outside the White House. I don't mean weekly vigils. All those things are very important. But what I really mean is picking up the phone, scheduling a meeting at the local district office in Washington, D.C., if you can make it, and beginning to build a relationship and a relationship of trust, with that office. And it only makes sense. We don't take advice from people we don't trust, neither do members of Congress or their staff. So we need to build these relationships. We need to build a sense of mutual respect and trust, and we need to figure out a way to more effectively engage with these members. And if you can't call or write or show up, the other thing you can do is write an op-ed in your local paper, an editorial, or a letter to the editor, and name your member of Congress, name your senators. They will see that publication, because every week there is a comms director, communications director, who will take all of the newspaper snippets mentioning their boss's name, cut them out, and hand them to that person in a packet. Normally it happens every day, sometimes it happens every week. But members of Congress want to know what people are saying when their name comes up. So you inevitably, your post will be read. It will at least be skimmed if you write a letter to the editor naming your member of Congress. And, you know, people think that our democracy hinges on whether or not you vote. And that, it couldn't be further from the truth. Our democracy and our republic, effectively, it only exists if you're willing to engage after Election Day. Election Day is very important, but what you do after Election Day is key to change. That is key. The reason why politicians don't keep their promises, whether it's Barack Obama, George Bush, the first with no new taxes or whatever, you pick the president, you pick the politician. The reason they're unable or unwilling to keep their promises is because they don't continue to hear from their constituents. We need a model of participatory democracy whereby people are engaged in their everyday lives on a regular basis, meeting with their members of Congress at least once every 3 months in order to really gain that kind of influence. And it doesn't matter what vision a member of Congress or even Barack Obama comes to Washington, D.C. with. If they don't have the grassroots backing, if they don't have that grassroots credibility, if they don't have people beating down the doors saying this is what we want, then they're not going to get to an agreement, and they're not going to move anything forward. And in my view, when you've got, you know, 25% of the population voting, of the voting population voting in a year election, you know, when the president's not running but the members of the House and the Senate are, and you've only got roughly half of your voting population voting during presidential election year, that's a real problem. People aren't voting because they feel like they're not going to be heard, like it doesn't matter. But that's a self-fulfilling prophecy that we must overcome. And the only way we're going to actually see the policies that we want to see is if we overcome that self-fulfilling prophecy and decide that this is important enough to engage on and do that. Not everyone will do it. That's okay. The Congress couldn't handle it if everyone did. But we need to build a bigger critical mass. We don't have enough people doing this work right now. We need to build that up.
Do you find out when you're out there in Hill working daily and all this stuff, okay? Do you find that the congressional staff are receptive when you're going in or you're working with them or you develop a relationship? Obviously, you're going to work a lot closer with others. When you have specific interests, work with committees, you have specific interests. But do you sense that they really want that participation? Because what I found before is if I get all the information, put it together and give them that information, give them a point of action that they can actually do something on, thank God.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, I mean, certainly members and staff crave that. They need it. And, in fact, you know, I've built a lot of really good relationships with staff, but my relationships are relatively limited with a staffer on a committee or a staffer in an office. unless I have constituent backing, unless the Friends Committee on National Legislation sends me with a constituent at some point to that member of Congress's office, and we sit down, one expert on an issue, which would be me, and one constituent of that district. That is the most effective meeting to have. If you're a constituent, you will your voice will trump all, and that is what we see consistently across the board. No matter the office, constituent voices matter. But what's really important, you can't just call and you can't just write, because the average congressional office gets some 4,000 pieces of communication per week. You can't just rely on those standard methods. You have to be willing to start to build a relationship if you want to be effective, if you want to build rapport with your members of Congress. If you don't build those relationships, it is virtually impossible to gain influence, because members of Congress, just like you and I, want to know that they can trust the people they're getting advice from. And the only way a member of Congress or their staff can know if they can trust you is if you can prove you represent more than yourself in the district, and if you can prove that you're a trustworthy person and a reliable person. And those two things, I think, are the absolute key for building power on a constituent level. And unless they start to happen more frequently, we might be in some trouble. We really need that here on the Hill.
Wow. Thank you, Matt. I mean, incredible. I mean, Denise has been saying this for a long time. Others have said it, but you've just said it, made it very, very clear. I mean, what made you decide to go into this whole area and work so hard to do this? And the clarity that you're expressing, how did you develop this?
Yeah, I mean, I started lobbying as a sort of a high school or a college kid, rather, after the Army. And I started organizing my fellow students to go to Washington, D.C. every spring and to lobby Congress. And what I basically saw, my observation in the 4 years that I did that while at Wilmington College, where I went to did my undergrad, my basic observation was that you could enfranchise people who were disenfranchised by proving to them that their voice and their opinion mattered. And the only way to prove that to them was to take them to Washington, D.C. on a charter bus on a 10-hour drive and to sit down with their member of Congress or their staff and actually say, this is what I think and this is why I think it, and have that staffer say, you know, we really appreciate your opinion on this. We're looking for constituent input. So that was what really motivated me to get started. I applied for an internship, came out here, started building a program around Afghanistan and ending the war in Afghanistan. And time and time again, what I saw was the constituents who took the time to build their own power with their member were most effective. It's a model that works. And frankly, it's a model that terrifies the defense industry and other mega industries, whether it's the pharmaceutical, the industrial agriculture, the industrial financial industry. This model terrifies them because the money matters and raising money to run a campaign matters, but what matters more than all of that is the vote. And if you're not satisfying your constituency and you're not getting their votes, then you're going to be in trouble on Election Day, and members of Congress know that. So, you know, and truthfully, the person who probably knows that better than anyone right now is Eric Cantor, who seemed untouchable not just a year ago, who just lost his primary and now will no longer be in Congress next year. Now, I'm sure that he'll make a nice salary at some K Street law firm or K Street lobby firm, one of the two, and that's fine. But the reality is, if we don't get more people doing this work and engaging their members of Congress the way that I've seen people do it over these, you know, last basically 10 years of being involved with this organization I work for, FCNL, the Friends Committee on National Legislation, if we don't do that, we're going to be in trouble.
How do people get in touch with the Friends Committee? Give us some contact information or a little bit, just
right,
the last couple of minutes.
The website is FCNL, F as in friend, C as in Charlie, N as in Nancy, L as in Lima, and that's .org. And you can have access to our action alerts. You can look up my bio. You can see things I've written. You can see things others on our staff have written. We work primarily, we're a nonprofit public lobbying, lobbying the public interest, or Quaker lobbying the public interest, rather. Been around for about almost 75 years. So long-standing history, and we work on a lot of different issues, from cutting the Pentagon budget to bringing peace to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, to preventing war with Iran and ending wars that we're currently in. We also have an environmental program, a Native Americans program, things like that. So we've been around for a while. We have a lot of different programs. I really encourage people to visit the website, take action if it's something that interests you, and check me out, check others out, and we're more than willing to help you find your voice on the Hill.
You know, I when I first gave a talk in a Quaker meeting center up in Massachusetts that had been founded at the time that our country was born, they've been around forever and ever and ever, working these issues and forcing the issues and direct involvement for, what, 300-400 years. So it's not
right.
It's a not an unknown fact. It's a direct involvement that's been actually good and healthy from what I've been able to see.
Absolutely.
Well, we're coming down the last couple of minutes. Haven't heard the music come up yet, but you got anything, last couple of minutes, you want to say anything or do anything? Matt, thank you very much. Again, this is Matt Southward from Friends National Committee on National Legislation, who's been our guest tonight on Warrior Connection. Anything, last things you want to say, Matt?
You know, I just want to say thanks for having me on, and I hope that people will hear my call to action and do what they can. I know everyone's in sort of a different place. Some people can make their trip to D.C. A lot of people can't, but do what you can. Every single piece counts. It all matters. So whatever it is that moves you, whatever it is that inspires you, even if your issue isn't war and peace, my plea is always to take the action that you feel like you can take on the issue that matters most to you. And if everyone does that, we'll live in a better world.
Sounds like a real good thing. Well, Matt, thank you very much. And ladies and gentlemen, have a good evening, and thank you for Warrior Connection. God bless you.